Russia fines Google and tech workers say, don't do that Wordle. From SDPB, today is Thursday, November 7th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, SDPB's Tech Talk panel gathers for human interaction about artificial intelligence. Ken Osborne, Jeff Litterick, and Amos Aesop are with me. Today, we'll explore a few tech headlines, including whether or not you know you are crossing a digital picket line. Then we'll look at new AI tools and how our panelists are using them. Gets a little spirited as we check in on how we're all making decisions about AI transparency and the trust gap. Plus, an exploration of behavioral design and tech addiction. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. Listening to In the Moment on SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Well, all week we have been talking about artificial intelligence. We kicked off the week with a panel from the University of South Dakota discussing AI for good. And then on Teacher Talk, we talked about AI in education. Today, AI in all things tech with SDPB's Tech Talk crew. Amos Aesop is Chief Security Officer with Exigent Solutions in Sioux Falls. Kent Osborne is Director of Digital for SDPB, and Jeff Litterick is a Network and Security Architect for the state of South Dakota. We're connecting today from Sioux Falls, Vermilion, and Pierre. We begin with some headlines. First one, Russia leveling a, shall we say, hefty fine on Google. Jeff Litterick, you brought this to our attention. Tell us a little bit about what's happening here.
Yeah, and this has been going on for a couple of years. Google has blocked because of the sanctions, a lot of Russian media sites, their TV, state TV sites and stuff, from putting up videos, and other people that have been sanctioned in Russia over the past few years. And Russia, it has impeded Russia's ability to get out their information, or at least their version of information. Yeah. So a couple weeks ago, Russia has fined Google a decalion, which is a one with 33 zeros behind it, which is greater than the entire world's GDP. And basically, Russia is trying to force Google to unblock these media outlets, and so that they can put up their information onto YouTube. It's kind of a weird way to try to force it, I guess. These are sanctions that the U.S. has, and I'm not sure Google could unblock those people if they want to.
Right.
But it's very weird. So the links Russia's trying to go just to get their message out, right? They're being blocked on YouTube, which is only one platform, and they can't seem to get their message out in a way they want, and they're desperate to get it out, so they're resorting to really weird court battles and pressure points and threats on Google. Just so that their state media companies can actually post videos on YouTube again.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting.
So how much is Google worth? So, Ken Osborne, this isn't...
Google's worth a couple trillion total in assets. They couldn't pay it if they wanted to.
But not a decillion or a... I don't even know how to say that word.
Not even close.
Decillion? Yeah. $20 decillion, Amos?
They said that Google had about $88 billion in quarterly revenue. And so, yeah, we're still a few exponential numbers short there, and that the entire gross GDP, the entire global GDP, is about $100 trillion, and so you're still exponentially short there as well. So, you know, this is all symbolic. I did read an article or something. It was imposing a fine of 100,000 rubles per day, with the total fine then doubling every week, right? So you got 700,000 rubles after 1 week, and then that doubles, plus then you pile on top of that. And eventually just gets to, you know, obviously absurd numbers. But I think
the interest really kills you, doesn't it?
It does. That's that compound interest phenomena. It's obviously largely symbolic. Will there ever be a penalty paid? Probably not. I can't imagine. Unless Google were to get to a point where they could, certainly utilize Russia's help in some way, or some way. I don't think that's going to happen, but they might concede a little bit of money in order to gain something that they're looking for. But yeah.
So what's actually at stake here?
News headlines really is about it, I think.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jeff.
A few years ago, Russia also tried to force Google to have a local in-country representative that they could, in their words, arrest and put in jail if Google didn't obey Russian laws. And Russia's done this with other companies, too. If you look it up, you'll notice that Russia usually demands local people representations that they can legally imprison if the resulting tech company does not do their bidding, so to speak, in Russia and obey Russian laws. So they've been known to put pressure points on this. It's just kind of so interesting that they're so desperate to get videos up on YouTube. Right. They have other avenues. You don't have to use YouTube. Though YouTube gets the biggest outside Russian audience, Telegraph and TikTok inside Russia probably get better audiences. So it's just kind of interesting how desperate they are to, you know, just get message out and information out to the rest of the world that they think is important. So.
Yeah. Kent, is that then to Amos's point about what they really want is the headline, hey, look over here, we're being maligned in some way by.
Yeah, never mind the invasion of another country. You know, let's talk about something else and
look over here.
Showboat about something else. I mean, we've all seen this in the previous weeks leading up to our election. Let's get concerned about this all of a sudden, and mm-hmm. it takes the focus away from that. And I guess in my advanced age, I've just gotten jaded to some of this. It's just like, you're showboating here, and why?
Right.
And it's because you can't have the thing that you want, you know, to have the thing. And so, you know, you're going to cry about it. It's hard to get upset about something or say it's free speech or whatever, because it's with the amount of hacking and other things that are bad that Russia is doing. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to get upset about blocking some YouTube channels.
A strange volley in the cyber war.
Exactly.
Which is not particularly an effective one, it sounds like, yeah. You're not going to apply for that job, Kent, to be the ground representative in Russia.
I would not like my office in the gulag, please.
Other headlines that are coming up right now, New York Times Tech Guild going on strike, and I didn't know who that was, and I'm learning some interesting things about what a Tech Guild strike looks like. Amos, tell me a little bit about the people who do this kind of work and have collective bargaining rights. What do we know?
You know, it's a lot tougher to go on strike in a virtual environment than it is in a physical environment. We see the strikes in front of the big automakers, you know, people carrying the signs and doing the march and the chants, and it certainly, you know, brings attention to the issues that they want brought attention to. It makes it so that it's not just behind closed doors and just amongst those folks who are having those discussions about, the bargaining that's going on. A little harder to do that when you're in the tech world, because what do you protest in front of when there is no edifice to do that for? And so I happen to notice that when this strike started, they were interested in having people stand in solidarity with them. Don't play our online games. Don't do Wordle. Don't use the cooking app. That sort of thing, which I suppose may have some effect. There's probably some ad revenue there that won't be generated because that's where they're making their money from, some of those items. But does it bring extra attention to those that aren't aware of the situation? I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah. And Jeff, you said maybe nobody will notice at all. Tell me about that.
Well, you kind of have to get the message out, right? And if it's not big enough to hit the national news and get people talking about, most people that use the app probably have no clue that, you know, it's not a third company they're programming this and that they're on strike to begin with, because I don't think the Times are going to put notices in the apps themselves that, hey, don't use this app because the people who developed it are on strike. We've had this in the gaming industry too quite a bit, with limited success somewhat when different people go on strike in the gaming industry. little bit smaller audience. Most gamers are more interested in the companies and actually are aware of that. But even then, I talked to lots of people that were never aware there was a strike going on or boycotts of, you know, that virtual app or that website or that game, right? Because you're kind of disconnected from it, right? Not on the national news. You're not seeing it, you know, on the TV screen of the picketers, like Amos said, in front of the building and stuff like that. You know, you go to a dealership and suddenly you can't buy a car. Those apps are still, you know, you can still get those. They may not be updated, but they still keep working. So most users may not notice any impact at all to even be aware that there's a strike going on unless they catch a headline on the Times website or something like that.
Yeah. And Kent, this comes election week, of course, which, you know, SDPB, if state tech workers went on strike and the journalists were saying, hey, wait a minute, this is the most important time for us to get our news out to the people, there might be some internal conflict. But what do you think of the timing of this, Kent?
Well, this isn't the first time that somebody has struck around the time of an election. It happened on the journalism side, you know, mm-hmm. way yeah. back in the day. So it's an interesting coincidence, and you look at their demands, some job protections, some remote hybrid work protections, which are actually things that a lot of folks are dealing with right now.
Yeah.
A lot of folks are being called back into the office or different things like that, and they're the tech workers are looking for, and this is about 600 folks are looking for the same protections that the newsroom union has had for decades.
Yeah.
So limits on subcontracting and some fair pay type stuff. Yeah. So it's this. I think unlike the story we just talked about, this actually has some meat to it. And it's a little bit easier to dig in on and really see the concerns and what's going on. And you're just right. It's the timing and the fact that it's not getting a lot of, I guess, traction in the news. And that's probably because of the time of year it is. I mean,
right. Everybody's looking at a different headline right
yeah,
now.
Everybody's looking at a different headline and they're looking forward to Thanksgiving and Christmas and a legislative session because we're all looking forward to that, aren't we?
Yes.
So I think, you know, it's interesting timing, but I think in the end, they have some really, really good concerns that'll probably get resolved mm-hmm. probably fairly quickly because it's nothing unusual. It's nothing crazy like the longshoreman strike. It's nothing like that. It's actual just some basic job protections.
Yeah. And, you know, we're sort of talking about it now. It could move kind of quickly or it could have an extension at that point. Amos, I was expecting when I read the article, and I read it in the New York Times because I'm a subscriber, so they're reporting on, you know, what's happening internally as well, and I think they did a respectable job of that. I was expecting there to be some sort of don't get rid of our jobs because of AI, and it is, to Kent's point, you know, pay increase, back to the office requirements that they're, you know, struggling with, pay equity. Are there other tech organizations that are fighting right now, like we saw the Writers Guild and the Screen Actors Guild, to say, wait a minute, we need to update our contract based on the rapidly changing technology in our industry?
Well, I think as journalists just in general are, you know, and it doesn't necessarily have to be specifically about national or international news. I know that this has been a problem for a journalist in the car industry for a while now because they have the ability to, you know, you mentioned AI, having an AI article written that uses all of the latest information, can go out and search all the stats, that sort of stuff. Still journalist nonetheless, but, you know, you don't typically think of that as really news related. It's just maybe car reviews, you know, what's the latest on EVs and, you know, what's being released this year from Toyota, that sort of stuff. So I've been seeing that quite a bit as well. Doesn't really have the same kind of connotation that maybe news reporting would, that mm-hmm. if that were to stop. But certainly it does extend into other areas.
Yeah. I had an ad pop up on me this weekend. It was for the New Yorker, and the line was, intelligence, nothing artificial. subscribe here. And that made me wonder if some of these organizations or publications are going to ease into the, this is where you come to for an ethic of AI usage that is minimalistic at best. In other words, you're not going to see anything that is a photo illustration, for example. It's going to be an artist doing the work, that kind of thing. Do you think, Amos, we'll start with you, you're going to see, is there a market niche for that? Obviously, the New Yorker would be.
Sure. And that's
a certain audience, yeah.
That's one of those things that you could, you know, the folks who have been doing illustrations or even taking photographs for the journalistic industry over time certainly get paid well because they're good at what they do. And using AI to replace that, A, is relatively inexpensive, you know, and B, really quick, and something that you could get on a moment's notice. One of the hard parts, though, is being able to get a realistic photo or a drawing that isn't obviously AI. And there have been some new announcements this week about new AI pieces or plugins that are capable of generating those sorts of things. The big one that I read about was the fact that it spells things correctly. I'm not sure if you've ever tried to generate an image in AI, but
no.
Have it put text on the screen.
Sure.
It's nearly impossible for it to spell it correctly. And there's a lot of theories about why that is, but it's almost universal that none of the image generators do that very well or do it very consistently. And so as that technology evolves and becomes better, it is going to put more pressure on those who were previously providing those sorts of pictures or drawings or whatever it happens to be, that artistic work,
yeah.
Because it's easier and faster to get it from ChatGPT.
Yeah. All right. We're going to talk more about that in a minute. But first, let's take a break. You're listening to our Tech Talk on listener-supported SDPB. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It's our Tech Radio Hour, and we have gathered around the virtual table in Sioux Falls, Pier, and Vermilion, all our Tech Radio experts. Amos Aesop here with me in Sioux Falls, Kent Osborne in Vermilion, and Jeff in Pier. So we left off before the break, Kent, talking a little bit about new AI tools, things that you're seeing on the market, what's popping up that's new, and then also I had mentioned, a company that was, popping up with marketing materials that said, hey, we're not going to do this. What are you noticing in the marketplace right now with AI tools?
Well, it's hard to come up with something new because, there really hasn't been much new. It's just getting better, I think.
Mm.
And Amos before the break was 100% right. Some of the stuff that you ask the generative AI stuff to do for you, really looks weird. languages and lettering and things like that. So it takes a little bit of playing around to get the images and the things that you want, but you can get it pretty close. It's pretty good. I think some of the more exciting things for me that could be considered new are some things in healthcare. Really being able to be adaptive to looking at what's going on with your body. There's some things going on with muscle movement and other things, and AI being able to interpret what's going on. And, it's just going to get better at helping possibly your physicians to come up with a plan for you or something like that. But I see the healthcare and the biometrics and that it's going to be weird for a while, but it's really about having something else in the tool bag to help with different situations.
So it seems to me, Kent, that one of the greatest promises of AI is that ability to, do the math on huge data sets. So I think of clinical trials and I think of, cancer research, and I get excited about that because you all know by now I'm a little skeptical of generative AI especially. But I do get excited in the healthcare arena. But are you seeing anything where you're opting in to share your data? Like, in order for that to be effective, a whole lot of people have to be willing to share information, whether that's DNA information or, you know, personal medical records. And I remember when my brother was sick, he was part of a clinical trial. And, you know, we kind of knew, we were hoping that he would get better, but we kind of knew he probably wasn't going to. And we had lots of conversations about, you know, participating in this trial and giving up this medical information in the hopes that somebody after me will benefit from it. He knew he was part of that. He was opting into it. Where's that line? What are you seeing, Kent, that people are opting into sharing information at the volume where we can actually see the benefits of the collaboration across healthcare partners, across the world with researchers?
Lori, that's a great question, and I don't have an answer for you.
It's a big question.
I don't know what everybody else is doing. I know what I'm doing, mm-hmm. and that is I usually pause, and then I check the box. And normally when I pause, I'm actually reading what they're asking me to do, and they're passing along a version of the data that is, you know, not specific to me or can't be tied back to me.
Yeah.
And that's okay. I, you know, it's kind of the people helping people kind of a philosophy. So I do want to participate in that. I, like you, would like to see this helping researchers. Hopefully it's not all hallucinogenic and leading people down rabbit holes, but finding things that maybe they didn't think about trying, mm-hmm. and gaming it out, and hopefully that timeline accelerates so much faster.
Yeah.
And that's what we've seen with everything else, is once that timeline starts accelerating, it just, you're able to work so much faster when it works better. And that's I guess my hope for getting rid of some of these really atrocious diseases.
Yeah. Jeff, do you see anything new that you'd like to add to this or add to the healthcare conversation specifically?
Well, yeah. Here's an interesting stat, and this is kind of gets back to the generative AI where you don't trust. Google has announced that over 25% of all of its new code is now created by AIs. AI is creating AI, because most of that new code is in the AI development, and that's generative AI creating itself, so to speak,
right.
and kind of bootstrapping it up. So that's kind of an interesting thing alone there. And to be honest on the security stuff, a lot of those big databases have been sold medically for a long, long time, long before AI. Mm-hmm. And there's a massive amount of information out there that's already been released as anonymous data, right, for studies and stuff. So the data is probably already floating out there. It's just getting the AI models to actually ingest it and stuff out, going back decades at this point, especially from previous medical research. So I think the data is out there. It's just a matter of getting the right AIs to actually process it and start making recommendations and then doing sanity checks, because sometimes AIs do dream and hallucinate. And it's now been proven that AIs actually, one AI will hallucinate playing Doom, the game, over and over again when it's not busy. So it's kind of interesting on some of that stuff.
Wait a minute.
Yes.
like a human being who goes to bed after work and like dreams about work, the game just will repeat, will fill its time.
Yep.
Oh, I don't know how I feel about that. Amos, what would you...
I thought it was kind of weird, too, when I first read that news story.
I read a news story, and I don't have it at my fingertips. It's been a few months now, but it was a true crime piece, and it came out of Texas, and they basically, long, long story short, investigators were on the trail of a potential serial killer, and they were able to identify through like Ancestry.com or one of those Ancestry type websites or companies, potential relatives of maybe who the killer was. And basically they went door to door in Texas and said, will you give us your DNA so we can get closer to who this killer might be? And like everybody said, yes. Even they were like, yeah, we'll help. And that goes back to kind of what Kent was saying, is the sense that, you know, like we are optimistic and we're hopeful. And even though a lot of people were like, there might be risks to my privacy, but they had watched enough, you know, or they listened to enough true crime podcasts where they were like, yeah, I might be able to catch a killer. And they did. And they arrested the killer with the same handcuffs that he had put on his victim. They checked him out of the evidence locker. and brought him to justice with the same handcuffs on. So it was this story that everybody kind of wanted to be part of the story.
Yeah, there's been a lot of cases solved through those commercial DNA databases anymore, following that same pattern you just kind of mentioned. They get to the relatives and then they kind of narrow it down. And sometimes they solve a lot of cases where the killers have been dead for 10, 12 years now. So, yeah, those databases are out there and they are being used. So,
yeah, lots of criminal justice. If you can't defend yourself and you are deceased, then what justice do you have to say that wasn't me? If for some reason the evidence points to you, lots of things to talk about there.
Yeah.
Any other new things that you're seeing come out? We're also looking ahead to, you know, getting closer to Black Friday. Maybe it's a little early for that conversation, but is anyone seeing anything that might be important new releases on that day? Kent, you want to start? Is it too soon?
I think it's too soon.
Okay.
I was actually just going to put a bow on the AI, and just besides the healthcare discussion, the whole AI thing isn't going away anytime soon. It's been predicted in the next 5 to 6 years, it's going to create AI. Isn't going to create the jobs, but AI in the AI field, 70 million jobs worldwide will be created, displacing about 20 million. So
what,
I guess
What kind of jobs does this create? And what kind of jobs does it displace?
That's a great question. The key to unlocking the growth and revenue of businesses is all about what, you know, executives are trying to get to. So they all think that AI is going to help boost productivity. So I think anything down chain from productivity of employees, and that's, you know, is that producing more widgets or is that doing things more efficiently or and cheaper? I'm not really sure. There's just a statistic that came out that said 70% of individuals would gladly delegate tasks to AI to ease their workloads.
Sure.
So is that a good thing? I mean, how are people's workloads these days? Are they overwhelmed because they're short people? And is AI going to fill in for that? It makes you wonder about that.
Is there something in your job today that you would want? Because I always come back to email. Like if AI can sort through my email and give me what I actually want prioritized, and then automatically shuffle the things I don't want into a little folder of, you know, darkness that I don't ever have to see. So that's one of the things that I think would just save me a ton of time, because I put filters on and I do the things you're supposed to do, but mostly I am overwhelmed by email, Amos. That's
And there are several email systems that have that today using AI. So Microsoft 365 has that. Google has that.
Wait a minute. Am I not doing this right then? Jeff Litterick, should I be doing something different in my email? Because I hate it.
You have to have the licensing for it, though,
oh,
right?
Okay.
So Copilot, which is part of Microsoft, which I'm assuming is where you're at, it requires a license. And many companies, rightfully so, are reluctant to roll out the Copilot license to everybody unfettered, right? Because the question is where is that data going? What are they using with it? Companies are concerned
about that little thing
about taking that AI that's going to read all your email and putting it into that large language database. And how do we know that that's protected? Now, in the Microsoft case, the theory is that it's within your tenant, right? Where you already are storing your items in OneDrive and SharePoint and that sort of stuff. But there's still a little bit of skepticism about that. And then if it gets outside of that, if you're in ChatGPT or in Google or whatever it happens to be, it's where is that data going and what are the protections around it?
Okay, so if you're sending me an email and you're sending an email to a journalist, you don't want me to have that.
Right, and there could
be
some privacy things.
You would like to send me a private email,
so
I don't want this after all.
Right, so if the journalists are receiving that sort of thing, which we see it time and time again in the news about how there is, you know, private information that somebody's received about something scandalous, and if that ends up in an AI model, who else might be able to get that if the right queries were processed?
All right, so what do you all want to have? Because now I'm stumped again, because I have a small AI imagination. Other than healthcare, I think big about that. But are there efficiencies at work that you think AI would help you that you're looking forward to? Amos, you start.
I use AI quite a bit, actually. So I use it for creating. So let's say I have to speak at a presentation. I need to start with an outline of something for, you know, whatever the particular topic is. I need some bullet points from that. And then I ask, you know, let's talk about this. And a lot of them you could have a conversation with, right? It's not just a one-time spit something out. It's a, here, this is what I want to talk about. What sorts of things should I be considering? What sort of resources should I be referencing? You know, if it provides you information and you like it or you don't like it, you can talk, you can tell it that. That's a great reference, but it seems to be a little too biased towards whatever. Can we find something that's a little more mainstream or something like that? And so it's really just working with an expert who you want to talk with a particular topic about. I use it all the time for those sorts of things, whether it's a presentation or a speech or, you know, giving something, creating a PowerPoint presentation, those sorts of things. Those are easy ways to use it.
Yeah. Ken?
Back in the day, I needed to know somebody that had the experience in X, Y, and Z. And I had to have this Rolodex, right? You remember what those are? That I had to know who to call to ask these very specific questions to formulate an opinion on something, and to understand both sides of an issue. I needed to know if this legislation that I was enacting was going to help more people than it was going to hurt, and I needed to understand both sides of issues. And you got to know who to call to ask these very specific questions, you know. And now you can be very specific, like Amos said, and you have access to loads of information, and you need somebody to dice that up for you, because, you know, it's just, otherwise it's a fire hose. We used to talk about that digital fire hose, and I was drowning in a digital fire hose. Guess what? This is a way to tone that down, to just take sips, very specific sips of things that you need to know about. And, you know, and I understand the reluctance, but I also understand, there's only so many hours in a day, and I got to get this stuff done, and I need an understanding of it to make my decisions to do this the best way I can. And that's why I'm willing to take these efficiencies. And you could, some people could call them shortcuts, but I've been taking shortcuts all my life on things.
Well, and I'm certainly using curated, you know, there's a curation, you know, like we were just talking before. I looked in my New York Times app to see what Times editors had on their technology headlines. So I'm going to a place that's already done a certain amount of curation for me of what the New York Times thinks is important in technology today. That's where I find the story on tech strikes. But then everything else is... So it's not like I'm not Googling anything, you know, or I'm just going to the library and looking in the microfiche. But no, I'm not asking the AI tool to generate an outline, to gather research, to do anything like that for me, yeah.
And, you know, when you say I'm Googling something, that,
right,
that
yeah,
Google's so. Been had AI in the background
exactly.
for 10,
yeah.
15
I have no
years.
Problem typing. It's not like I'm using nothing.
But so that AI exists. It's just being presented to you in a way that doesn't look so much like the direct AI tools. But it is. It's just a similar way. And you don't, A, always get an accurate answer, right? So you got to make sure that you're validating that. And B, it's all predicated on how you ask your question. What are the prompts that you're giving it in order to get the right information out? And I don't see that any different than using Google to provide that same information.
Yeah, we're going to talk more about this in a moment. You're on Listener Supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We have our Tech Talk panel of experts gathered around the state. Jeff Litterick is in Pierre, Amos Aesop here with me in Sioux Falls, and Kent Osborne joining us from Vermilion. And we went to break talking a little bit about new AI tools. I want to move into what tech companies know about technology and addiction here in a minute. But first, Jeff Litterick, I don't think we got to you. Did you have anything else you wanted to add to sort of how we're making these decisions, especially the question of, like, should you be using AI for this particular application in your life or at work?
Well, here pretty soon, that's not going to be the question. It's going to be, can you even not use AI? AI is going to be in everything. And what, you know, we talked a little bit about Office 365. We are testing it. Teams has an AI on the premium license now that actually does full transcripts, analysis of every meeting and the people in the meeting. It's actually a really great tool, and it's going to be built in and just basically runs whenever you have a team meeting or when you are running Word. It's going to give you AI suggestions on grammar and stuff in the background, or you're doing email, it's going to put the imported emails to the top. That's all going to be very soon baked into everything we do. So you will be using substantial AI for just about everything in one way. Now, the direct asking AI direct questions, that is a different matter, but AI behind the scenes is going to be every place, and you're not going to be able to really get away from it much. Even, you know, companies that say we don't do AI, they're finding AI generated stuff all over those companies because they're subcontracting it out. It's almost impossible to stop at this point. So that's going to be the hard decision if you don't want to use AI, to not use AI.
It makes me crabby.
We have an AI service that we use on our Zoom calls that is unbelievably efficient.
Right.
It listens to everything we talk about on Zoom and then spits out what are the top 10 things to do after this meeting.
Sure.
And it makes everybody so efficient because you all get a report of that. And now,
how is it going to change how we interact in meetings?
I don't have to sit and talk and comprehend and write my notes at the same time because I know the system will provide me those notes.
This is how I comprehend the meeting.
And even if there's a minor,
I comprehend the meeting by taking the notes.
Sure.
And now my notes are going to be okay. Anyway, we can spend a whole hour of you guys telling me how stupid I am.
Nope.
But I stand that there are listeners who agree with me right now, and that I get it.
Sure.
Fine. I mean, that's a great that is a great application. Everybody in the meeting knows that it's happening. You know, the notes would be great, that you don't have to type up your notes. You don't have to reference them and say, remember how we decided last week? I mean, I totally get that. However, I'm also wondering about people who show up in meetings in different ways and how the presence of AI and that kind of note taking might change how you participate in a meeting. I think that's just worth considering is all I'm saying.
Sure.
Not saying you wouldn't use that tool. That sounds like a great tool. Yeah. However, it might change. And I'm still going to take notes.
And the nice part is it's not obtrusive. I mean, so if you want to continue to take notes, it doesn't get in the way of that.
Oh, thank you.
It doesn't, but it's not requiring you to act differently, right?
Right.
If you choose not to.
Put down your pens.
You
yeah.
can do it however you want.
Yeah.
That's the nice part is it's subtle.
We've all got our workflows, and yours is just a little different than some other ones, and it's not. We're not saying that's bad.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Yes, I have things to offer the world still. That's going to be outsourced soon. The bot will do the podcast for us.
No, I just need a little extra help with this. I mean, there are talks that I've given at conferences, and I wished that I could have. Oh, I just should have remembered to get a recording of that, so that at the end I can summarize all the things that came up from ideas from other people, and it's a very conversational kind of a thing.
Yeah.
I'm giving a presentation in front of a couple hundred people. I don't have time to take notes. I wish I had a digital assistant doing that for me.
And I'm talking. I confess from a point of privilege. I have two outstanding human producers who I get to work with every single day, and I often say, hey, can you find me this? Can you find me this? And they are off doing that research. So that is a wonderful, I have a great team that functions optimally for finding information, and not everybody has that. And I know grammar because I studied it, and not everybody, right? So, I mean, I definitely want people to, and when I taught writing, grammar should not get in the way of anybody having their story told. So I believe in that, too. You know what I'm saying. My hesitations are not necessarily revolutionary. They're pretty common.
Sure. And there's nothing wrong with them.
Thank you.
I mean, it's just an evolution. I mean, you've got AI. You've got actual intelligence, people who are doing things and helping you with it. This is just an artificial version of that. And really, it's just to encourage efficiency and access for everybody because I don't have any producers, and I still need help.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk a little bit about what we know about tech companies and addiction, because there is a darker side to when we hear what is happening inside some of these companies. It sounds very much like what you heard from tobacco companies when some of the whistleblowers came out and said, not only do they know it's addictive, but they're creating a product that is as addictive as possible, And then externally or public facing, they're saying, oh, we don't think, we would never do that. But we're finding out a little bit, and Jeff, why don't you kick us off with this, that many of these companies are in fact doing the thing that we, would hope that they would not do, which is trying to make their product as addictive as it possibly can be for young users.
I'm going to give you a sad fact. Most companies now, tech companies, have hired entire teams that specialize in human addiction, in human basically manipulation, to be able to make their products not only more attractive, but addictive. And a good example of this is in the mobile gaming industry. They actually have, I think one company had more people on the human side to make it more addictive than they had on the programming side. Loot boxes and games are a direct output. It's a dopamine hit every time you get one and you open it and you find a prize. It's kind of like gambling, right? In fact, you notice a lot of these addictions and what they put in some of this stuff is kind of gambling and designed to hit that emotional release. And those are by design. They have psychologists and teams of people just trying to manipulate the game to get dopamine hits of people. And it's not just even young, though they tend to be more prone because of their emotional balance and less experience to that kind of stimuli. But it's also for adults and stuff. And it's rampant through the tech industry. I don't think you could find a tech company that does it in their marketing, have some kind of human basically manipulation group that to make their products more attractive and more desirable to be used. And of course, then you give them more and more monies about it. So,
any accountability for this in the world? Are we just all accepted that this is how it's going to be? And then perhaps we could also go back to healthcare and talk about how the gamification of something can actually, help you if you are, practicing, biofeedback, and the app gives you a reward for every time you meditate, and some of these things could be used to really help people build healthy habits. However, largely they're not.
Right. Yeah. This is called behavioral design. Ugh. This is tech companies using this. Yeah, to create, this is all about money, dollars. Mm-hmm. If you can keep eyeballs on your app, you keep people engaged in your app, you can keep serving them ads, and you can make more money. That's the root of all evil, right? and that's the root of this problem. Is they've, and we've all seen this for years, the like button, mm-hmm. They used to talk about that in Facebook, and then in Instagram, you got the little heart and whatever, and you find yourself, if I put this photo up, are people going to like it? And then, I need to open the app again to find out. And so it's nothing really new, but they're just, these behavioral designers have figured out the correct, what's the word I'm looking for behind this? The correct numbers and the
algorithm
and the algorithms. Thank you. To really finely craft and design these apps to keep people engaged the longest. And people have been addicted to. There's been drug abuse problems in all different classes, and there's been digital device addiction. I saw a great example of that this weekend. I looked up from what I was doing, and everyone I saw had their face in their phone. And they weren't talking to other people. They were just engaging with their digital device. Mm-hmm. And I was in a place where people should have been communicating, and they weren't. So so digital device addiction is part of it. Gaming addiction. Gamers are losing sleep. Over half have said that they're missing sleep because of gaming, and a lot of them have skipped meals. So that's a nutrition and a health concern. So that's going on, and it's just thing after thing after thing is a concern when it comes to this particular problem. And you asked, how do we, you know, how do we fix it or how do we do things with it? I'm not really sure. I'm encouraged by what I'm seeing happen in some schools now for younger folks. It's gonna take, with us older folks, and I'm speaking for myself here, it's going to take some work to break some of these chains and really get past it so that I can concentrate on health and, yeah, you know, nutrition and sleep and other things. I myself used to stay up till all hours of the morning gaming, and I've had to break that addiction. And it came when I got my CPAP machine and I needed to focus on health and do other things. So I had a reason to do it, mm-hmm, and I got it done. And thank goodness. I think my wife would still say I'm probably a little bit addicted to gaming, but I try to slip in a game here or there when I have a little bit of extra time.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to imply, again, I don't want to leave people with the impression that making money is bad or that having a successful, you know, product or company or game is necessarily bad. So we are looking at some of the negative aspects of this, or some of the intentional behavioral design, is that what you called it? Mm-hmm. That maybe is not, I mean, most big companies, I would hope, fingers crossed, have some kind of ethics in their leadership, and that they're not just monsters running around trying to destroy the world. So I don't want to be too negative
here.
Well,
and I think we're seeing that too. I think we're seeing that companies like Samsung and Apple and the device manufacturers themselves are building in abilities to limit screen time, right? I get a report every Sunday night that says this is how much screen time you use as compared to last week, just for being aware. Because some people with that addiction might not be aware of how much time they're spending on those things. So, you know, there are tools that are being developed to help curb that. I think as Kent was talking about earlier, part of that, I mean, we need to treat it like a regular addiction. You got to be aware that you have it in order, mm-hmm, to start working on it, et cetera.
Right.
So there's...
You have to understand that you have it. Somebody else might be telling you that you have it.
Yeah.
Might be that... I'm sure we have interventions and people are coming to other people and their family and saying, hey, you got a problem. We have to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Anything less? We have like 2 minutes left. RCS versus SMS. Oh, the things I will ask that are so basic and common. Somebody please explain to me what that is and what's going to happen on my iPhone.
Yeah, SMS was designed back before there were smartphones. It was designed for cellular text messaging. Before a smartphone or, you know, data even existed on cell phones, right? It's unencrypted. It's limited 160 characters text. RCS is its replacement standard. And it basically gets away from the cellular. It's encrypted. It's multimedia. You can put in images, pictures. It doesn't have the limitations. But it doesn't actually run over cell. It actually runs over a data connection. So you have to have a smartphone in order to be able to use it. But then the industry, everyone has smartphones on cellular networks now. So, but you don't need a cell phone to use RCS. You can do it over any kind of internet media. So it's basically just a replacement of SMS with a lot more features and security and much more accessibility.
And you're not going to really notice anything different.
Well, you notice a lot more emos and pictures and stuff like that.
But I already
between
have
cross
that.
Platforms.
Oh, cross well, platforms.
Apple,
okay.
Yeah, Apple had made their own standard called MMS, which does the same thing as RCS, but RCS is the standard for everybody else. So
there it is. Okay.
As they move into RCS, you'll be able to cross talk to everybody else with this those same features you use in MMS today.
All right. Makes sense. Any final things? Things you're looking forward to, things that are happening in the world right now, things you're excited about?
Let's just wait and see how this election results turn out, huh?
Let's just wait and see how the election results turn out. Amos, Jeff, Kent, is always a delight. Thank you so much for being here. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.